Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and thank you for tuning in to our Thursday night programming of Totally Driven Radio. But why wouldn't you tune into the greatest show heard all around the world? And happy Friday. Happy, this could be noontime for you on Friday if you're here on the East Coast, or good morning to you on the West Coast. Or if you're in another country, good evening. So how about that? We're going to cover all bases here. Anyway, my name is Bay Ragney. You're listening to Totally Driven Radio. And we have a little special edition for you this afternoon, or this evening, or this morning, whichever you prefer, or whenever you're listening to this. So, you know, one of the biggest bands on everybody's tongue right now is Queen, and that is, you know, partially doing thanks to not only their amazing music over 40 years, but the new movie, Bohemian Rhapsody. And there's a tribute band that's actually from the UK, and they're probably one of the biggest tribute bands of Queen and tribute bands in general around the world. I mean, they've won awards for being the best tribute band in the world. So, but they are a Queen tribute band. They're called Killer Queen. And I got to talk to Mr. Patrick Myers the other day, who portrays Freddie Mercury in Killer Queen. And we had an amazing conversation on the history of the band, his love of Queen, and, you know, being a tribute band before there really was even tribute bands, and how this whole thing just kind of started for fun and got pretty serious pretty quickly, and how they're drawing these huge crowds around the world and selling out the same arenas that Queen sold out in their day. So it's kind of a whole, it's kind of weird. You got to admit, it's kind of weird, right? So, but anyway, like I said, they're called Killer Queen. His name is Patrick Myers, and here he is. Patrick.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
How are you? Good. How are you?
Very good. Great.
So, you know, it's funny, like, let me ask if you were the same way. Like, I was a kid of the 70s growing up, so back then, naturally, the big band for me was Kiss. And I would dream of being, you know, in a Kiss band when I grew up. You know, way before the term of tribute bands or tribute bands even existed.
Yeah.
So, you know, fast forward, you know, all these years later, and there's tribute bands, many Kiss tribute bands and a Queen tribute band like yourself. Did you ever think, like, were you kind of the same way growing up, like thinking you wanted to be in a Queen band?
I mean, I guess like you, when we were growing up, and even, you know, when I first, more or less when we did our first concerts, there weren't tribute bands everywhere. That's how it started for us, because there weren't any tributes. And so when I was a little boy, the idea of pretending to be another band was, my version of it was that I'd go back in time and be that person somehow.
Right.
You know, like, I'd be hanging out with, or I'd sort of like, you know, a Queen was sort of like, I didn't really know their history when I first heard their music. All I knew really was their music. The only history of a band I knew was the Beatles, and I knew they'd sort of done this thing in Germany and then come over. So when I was a little boy, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to be hanging around and having beers with the Beatles in Hamburg before they were famous and that sort of stuff. So that was that. Yeah, I never. But that, the idea of actually pretending to be a band was a totally, no, it didn't even enter my head that you'd do that. I thought, you know, that was just, in fact, you know, the first time I heard about tribute bands, I thought that was just insane. I thought, why would you do that?
Right.
So, which is kind of ironic, really, because, so what happened was, as the tribute scene emerged a bit later, you know, we sort of, I wouldn't say we were unaware of tributes. We sort of knew that there was a tribute to ABBA going around. But there's certainly, when we got the news that Freddie died, we all just left home. And, we realised we weren't going to be able to see a Queen concert, you know, self-evidently, because Freddie was no longer there. But we were kind of like the first generation that wouldn't, because we were all just, you know, young kids. So we thought we'd put a concert on for everyone else, and part of that would be dressing up as Queen and doing the whole thing, in a kind of sort of like, you know, a way of trying to be at the concert you can't be at, for ourselves, really, and for everyone our age. And yeah, we thought, yeah, this might be good fun to do. And, you know, this might lead to a couple of really being invited to some really groovy parties or something. But that was about it. You know, we didn't really have a plan. We didn't even know how to get a show. And what happened was we accidentally became the headline act of the entire Ball of London for all the students, which was a surprise to us. Yeah, no, I know. This was the first ever show. It's not like we started small. What happened was we had this act. We put it together. It'd taken us about a year and a half following on from Freddie's death to sort of finally sort of like work it up, get the costumes, get the whole thing ready. But we were all sort of like dressed up with nowhere to go because we had no show at all and no idea of how to get one. It was before the internet. You couldn't just look stuff up. You just had to know people or know how to do things. There was no magic guide. That you could reference, you know, we just knew nothing. We were, as I say, we were very, very, very young kids. And what happened was the major ball that was going to go in London, the big event of summer, they'd messed up. They were supposed to have one of the big indie Britpop acts playing, and they hadn't got the right license done in time. And they were stuck that the council weren't going to let them put on any kind of show whatsoever. They said, no, you can't do it. You haven't got your license in. You're lost. The only thing they couldn't stop them doing was putting on a student band, but they thought, we can't put on a student band. Who the hell's going to turn up and see a student band for the main ball of London, you know? Then someone whispered in someone's ear, hey, there's a guy that's done this Queen tribute band, and he's all, you know, they're great. They've heard their stuff, but they've never done a show before, but if you want to take a risk, give it a go. So he did.
Wow.
We did our first show in front of a thousand or so students, and that was the first time we'd ever heard music live, Queen music live like that. We'd only ever seen it on videos and seen the concert footage and stuff, but the first time we were actually in a concert hall with that music powering out, even though we were the ones singing it, with an audience singing it back, that was just magic for us. Wow. Because that was that kind of big experience we'd sort of like been hoping for all those years since Queen had last toured, you know, which was now a few years back, you know. So yeah, that's how it all started. So it wasn't, hey, let's all do what everyone else is doing and do a Queen cover band, because there weren't any. If there were Queen cover bands, we wouldn't have bothered. We'd have just gone to see one. But because it's a lot simpler to do it that way around, you know. But because there was nothing, we just didn't think, you know, that would be a possibility. Or as I say, the tribute thing wasn't really a big exploding scene at the time. It was on its way, but it hadn't really arrived. But yeah, so that's how it began for us. But yeah, no, I know. I think everybody in their head when they're a kid, you know, that's how you learn to do anything. When you pick up a guitar, you, sure, you copy someone's riff. You know, when you listen, you first hear Elvis Presley's voice, you think, God, can I make my voice do that? And all that sort of, you know, you just try stuff out by copying. And then eventually you move into your own style. But we just got stuck at the first bit. We started copying and never stopped. So, you know.
Now, again, like, that was way before the internet, so it wasn't like you can just go, you know, on YouTube and watch all these videos of Freddie. I mean, that was, guess you were through a lot of VHS tapes at the time.
It was, we just went through, we all had different bits. Like, I had a video, everyone else in the band had different videos, or the same videos, and we all sort of pulled our sources. And we even were ringing friends of friends of friends up and, like, travelling on the tube across London to try and get hold of another video that had a bit of information that we wanted to see again. Because you're right, you couldn't just dial up stuff. You know, you had to really search for it. We even tracked down Freddie Mercury's original costume designer, Natasha Kornilov. Well, she didn't design all of them, but she designed a lot of the stuff for Hard Life video and things like that. And she did David Bowie stuff as well. So she happened to be, you know, living quite near where we had our college in London. So, and we went to see her and had tea and chatted all things Queen. And she didn't actually design any of our costumes in the end, but it was just great. We just basically were having fun, you know. This was just us, you know. We were doing degrees. I was doing a degree in drama and acting and stuff, and my friends were doing degrees in conceptual art and all sorts of stuff, and English and all, you know, and costume design and a whole range of stuff. So we were just all clubbing together and thinking, well, this is good fun, isn't it? You know, it was like, you know, because it was, you know, and we at that time, it didn't cross our mind that, you know, trying to take off Queen is actually quite tricky. It sort of gradually dawned on us as we sort of like got further and further into their sort of canon of work that, oh, we've got quite, this is why it sort of took us quite a long time. We suddenly thought, hang on, we need to really work out what we're doing here. This needs some serious preparation. But anyway, we sort of hit the ground running. And we, as I say, we hit this weird sort of scheduling problem, and we stepped into the breach, and it completely launched our career. The guy who put us on said, no, that this isn't going to be your one and only show. We are going to give you a tour. And I went, yeah, right. I said, if you don't believe me, just call me up in a week and I'll have 20 dates for you, or 20, 30 dates. And he did. We called him, you know, within a couple of weeks, there was a whole tour right the way across England. And about a year and a half after that, so that would be moving towards sort of 94, 95, there was talk about a West End show for us. So we did a residency in the West End by the Christmas of 95. And then that led to stuff on. That was national TV coverage and national papers, double page colour spreads, and then all over Europe. And it just kept on going. We were just somewhat surprised. I tell you what got really strange. The arenas, you know, the new millennium happened. And we were still trucking on, doing Queen everywhere. And the arenas that Queen had played in, this is before they'd got back together again, just a little bit before. And they said, look, we really want a Queen show. We want you to be it. Would you come over to Holland and then later in Belgium and even Beirut and come and design a show with us? We'll get together and work out the lighting rig, the whole design, the pyrotechnics, the lot, you know. And so we did. I did loads of meetings. We went over and did loads of publicity, and we actually sold out the same venues that Queen did. Which was really trippy. Yeah, I know. I know.
Watching the videos, it's just like so mind-blowing to see, you know, these like 10,000-15,000 you know, crowds of 10,000-15,000 people. It's like, wow. Yeah.
I know, but that's what it's like for us. I remember, I tell you what, you know that thing you said, you know, I remember watch about, you know, when you were a kid. I remember when I was watching, they broadcast the last tour they did fairly quickly after it happened at Wembley. I didn't get to see it, obviously, because I was a bit too young, but I stayed up with my mum and I watched it. And I remember watching it back some years later, and I caught this look that Freddie, he's just, it's right at the opening of they've just done their first number and they're just segueing into the second number. And Freddie's doing that, you know, running around the stage, and then he runs up to the top and then he's running down the stairs right by the drum kit, and he turns away from the crowd and looks at Roger, and he gives Roger a real gleeful look, you know, like, it's good, isn't it? And that Roger sort of grins and nods back. And to me, what I liked about that is it reminded you that even though these were very, very seasoned rock stars by this stage, somewhere inside Freddie and Roger, they were just two kids going, I can't believe we're doing this, can you?
Right.
Even though they, you know, it was still exciting and fun for them, you know what I mean? And that little tiny look they gave each other, for me, that kind of resonated, because I thought, you know, it was like, yeah, there's sort of, everybody starts out as a kid, everybody starts thinking, God, I wonder if, you know. Now, it's a bit weird that, I mean, it's a bit weird that we've done this via dressing up as another band, I have to say. That still somewhat baffles me, even now, having done it for all these years as a concept. But I have to say, once you've stepped into those shoes and you've started having that fun, and you've sort of like made, you know, you've made your bed and think, okay, I'm gonna try and make this as good as I can. It's brilliant fun. It's excellent fun.
It's been what, 25 years now you're doing this. So is it kind of hard to turn Freddie off at times and bring Patrick back?
What, off stage, you mean? Oh no, it's incredibly easy. I'm really not. Freddie was, you know, his own chap, and I think I had a bit of a training in acting growing up. So for me, the idea of staying in character was just weird. I mean, why would you do that? You step on stage and you're doing that, and then you step off stage and you're not doing that. You're doing something else. So no, I've no desire to sort of start. I mean, Freddie's whole thing on stage was such a performance, you know. I mean, he didn't sit there sort of playing Scrabble and, you know, answering Christmas cards. You know, he was performing, you know, he was doing his thing. So you can't walk around, you know, doing your shopping as Freddie Mercury performing on stage. Because that's going to be a bit, that's going to draw somewhat unwarranted attention, I think. So, you know, it's a performance, and his whole performance style was geared to, you know, breathing every moment on stage and communicating all that music and you know, through to his fingertips and stuff. He was a sort of lightning rod for that, but you can't live your life as a lightning rod.
Right.
Ordering a taxi with an operatic baritone or whatever, you know. Uber. It's certainly good fun on stage, that's for sure.
Now, actually, I got to my whole family, my wife and my daughters are all big Queen fans, and we went and saw them with Adam Lambert a few years ago when he came to Philly. And
yeah, amazing!
I got to admit,
I saw those,
like,
too.
When, you know, when they give that tribute to Freddie and they start showing him on the screens, like,
yeah,
me and my
yeah.
wife both break down and start crying. Like,
oh, absolutely!
Like,
it's inevitably deeply, deeply, deeply moving when that stuff happens, and particularly when, you know, and Brian now sings Love of My Life and Freddie joins at the end and stuff like that. It's not just at the end of Bohemian Rhapsody now, there's other little moments. And, you know, I think that's what you get from the film as well. You get a sense of, you know, even though they became separated and alienated from each other during the course of the career, as, you know, in the inevitable sort of ebbs and flows of how these things worked, they were kids starting out together too, so they became, you know, that kind of brotherhood thing, you know, that bands sometimes get. And they were there, you know, and certainly in the later years, you know, when they, you know, there was a lot of reconciliation and getting back together and a lot of amazing studio work, you know, they were very much a family for each other at their best. And and you so feel that when you see Brian looking up with his old mate on stage, you know, on the screens, and you sort of feel Freddie there as well. That's what's really touching about it, because music is kind of, and you know, that's a voice echoing through a stadium. Those, you know, that's, I don't know. I think it's great. I think it's I think there's something pretty magical about music, full stop. But Queen certainly have got that magic. I don't know, bottled somehow. They've got it on tap.
I'll tell you what, right now I have chills talking about it. I really do.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Do you see, like, anybody in the crowd move the tears when you're performing?
We get, yeah, you do, and you get emails about that at the same time. I think it's a, you know, it's a combination of things. I think Freddie was such a charismatic performer, and Freddie's no longer with us, so there's that inherent sadness, but there's also the fact that these songs are incredibly good. They're incredibly well written.
Yeah.
And they've been around a while, so they've worked themselves very firmly into people's lives, you know. They've sort of weaved in and around all the, you know, a lot of major events of people's lives, births, deaths, funerals, you name it, you know. It's everywhere, that music. And so it means a lot, you know, on a personal level to people, as well as on a sort of wider context of Queen as a band and Freddie as a performer. So yeah, no, it's a, it, but you also get, I mean, I wouldn't want to characterize our shows as a sort of morning weep fest or anything. You get a lot of
right.
a big emotion, you know, as well. And that covers a wide range of bases. You get a lot of complete, you know, delirious kind of mayhem that goes on. And I mean, I think Freddie and Queen and Brian and Roger and John, they wanted to create an exciting, unforgettable atmosphere in a Queen concert. And I think it wasn't just, oh, lovely lights and this, that and the other and pyrotechnics, you know, with a Queen concert. You wanted it's the atmosphere, essentially, that sense of complete rock and roll overdrive that you wanted to, and that exhilaration that you get from that as a crowd. And I think that's what we were hankering after as kids when we put our first show on. It was that feeling, that buzz, you know. And so that's what we are kind of, you know, as I sort of grandly call our mission statements. But that's kind of on definitely much, you know, in the top three of what we want to get done. You know, we want to give to a crowd and make sure that happens every night. So yeah,
sure.
But that also makes it really exciting for us. It makes it, you know, like a kind of, it's like a real regular charge of adrenaline and excitement as performers on stage too.
Has any of the members of Queen seen you guys perform?
What the sort of the members of Queen themselves have got their own Queen tribute, which is amazing, called a Queen Extravaganza. So they keep the rest of the whole tribute thing at a slight polite arm's distance. So we're cool with that. But the sort of periphery things around that, like Brian May's website, they've said some lovely, fantastic, and you know, great things about us. As have Brian May Guitars, his the company he runs that sort of makes those amazing instruments that. That we've been using for years, and they're just fantastic. So yeah, we've had a lot of nice things said about us over the years from those sort of quarters. But Queen themselves have keep their counsel, because they save their intense laser beam spotlight for their own tribute, which is fair enough, I guess. But yes, no, it's great, and we've had some lovely awards from various venues over the years and things. So that's been great too. But I think for us, because we're coming in it from the point of view as we were the fans, you know, sort of
right.
Hanging outside the, you know, with the stadium door shut in our faces, that, you know, we weren't going to get out to see. We want our reaction primarily is kind of geared towards, I mean, lovely as it would be to get, you know, endorsements from Green, all that sort of stuff. Our reactions are primarily geared towards what the people who love Queen, the fans like ourselves, think and want. So that's our sort of sounding board, really, in terms of where we go with the show and how we're doing and how we tweak it and refine it and that sort of thing. But I mean, essentially, you're working with such great material. I mean, the songs are so great. They all wrote such different styles of songs, but they all gel together so great with that kind of really malleable but utterly recognizable Queen signature sound. So yeah, great. I mean, it's a pleasure to work with all this stuff.
Do you think you guys get much flack from like original bands? Because let's face it, original bands are out there and they're not drawing. You know what I mean? And are having such time. And
yeah,
you guys
I don't really think I think there was a little bit of that when tributes first started. Because certain clubs would suddenly go all tributey and nothing else. But we never really played those clubs. We never really did the club scene and just played tribute. Land, if you know what I mean. We try to, if only because it just seemed like a circuit that you just lead to more stuff like that. And we kind of had a vague, once we realized that this was great and we could really, you know, have fun with this, we thought we'd try to steer ourselves towards a sort of slightly upscale sort of thing, because Queen sort of fitted that environment a bit better than, you know, than a tiny, tiny, tiny club or something. So in order to serve that environment, you know, we tried to aim for those sort of venues, which I guess you could call it ambitious, but it was more sort of practical as far as we were concerned. We just thought, look, it works better in those, so let's go for those. I understand that, but I think if anything, rock and the whole music industry in terms of popular music is at a funny stage, because people have sort of stopped buying music. So it's become the live event for all the acts, whether they're original acts or not. The live event is the event for music. That's how people can remain as musicians. So I think it's more a symptom of the fact of what happened with the music industry that these things are happening. But also because it's at this sort of natural kind of hiatus point that people don't buy music anymore, and the whole industry is sort of working out, scratching their heads and working, well, what do we do? Just keep doing gigs? How do we get new material out there? Because we're at a slightly sort of, as I say, a bit of a hiatus, it is kind of inevitable that after 50, 60, you know, nearly 70 years now of rock and roll, you're going to turn around and say, well, what's in the tank? You know, what have we got here? You can't just, and yes, of course, you've got to keep creating music, and new music is still being created. There are great songs being written every day. Not everyone gets to hear them, that's for sure, but they're still being written. Music never stops. But at the same point, you can turn around. There's no harm in just turning around and saying, let's stop and smell the roses, you know, a little bit here. Let's look at these amazing performances and this amazing, you know, thing that was, say, the Beatles or Queen or any of the real greats, And I think that's great. I think the thing about popular music is that it's not just music. It's 9 times out of 10 a visual. It's a lead performer. It's a combination of personalities. Right. It's not just anyone playing some songs. Otherwise, it just ends up, you know, people say, "Oh, you're in a covers band." And I go, "No, it's not a covers band. A covers band is people who turn up as themselves and just play covers. This is a totally different thing." What you're trying to do is recreate the package. You're trying to create. I mean, obviously, you can't be someone else. We are aware of the gulf that you know, that can exist between, you know, Freddie Mercury and the rest of the, you know, mortals on the planet, but and Brian and all the others. But what you can do is you can go down the blueprint that they left of how they look, the visuals, and get as much of it as you can, as close as you possibly can, with the talent that you're bringing to the table, so that when you put your show on, you're giving permission to the audience when they walk through the door to give permission to themselves to feel like that they're at the Impossible Concert. And that's the thing. And I think there's no harm in celebrating that and in celebrating it in precisely that way. It doesn't all have to be, oh, we don't want to dress up as the band because that somehow makes it seem silly. I think it doesn't make it seem silly. I think there's a ridiculous element to any kind of performing. But I think once you embrace that and get past it, you can really engage in the full experience of what it was like to share that music in a live environment. And of course, if the costumes augment that and the way that you speak to an audience helps that along, do that as well. I mean, I don't want to break the magic by suddenly saying, "Hello, my name's Patrick Myers. I'm really glad you enjoyed our very worthy renditions of Queen." Who wants to hear that? Nobody wants to hear that. And by the way, I'm going to play you some jazz standards now that I just recorded that's on a CD outside. You know, stop it. You know, don't do that. That's just give them the thing that they're missing, you know? I mean, that's the way I take it. But yeah, sure. I think people are generally relaxed about, I mean, I think a good tribute is a good show, essentially. And you don't get cross, you know, when there's a good revival of a great musical or something. You know, you don't get cross that, oh no, Chicago's back in town, or how dare they? You know, you think, well, it's a great show. People should see it again. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's a little bit of that. People are beginning to calm their pants down a bit about the whole tribute thing and realize that, look, okay, you're going to get really good tribute shows and they're great shows in their own right. So yeah, live and let live. Meanwhile, great songs, as I say, are being written and, you know, great acts are still coming through, and it's whether the music industry eventually finds a way of flogging music to the masses again, I don't know. But in the meantime, let's all have some fun with what we've got, you know.
Absolutely. Now, do you work on any original music of your own, or?
I do, and I just keep it. Because I'm touring this quite a lot, I sort of would like to have a home life too. I kind of get a bit conflicted about spending the time I do get at home away from everybody, locked away recording. But I do actually record music myself a little bit. It's not something I'm burning with the desire to release into the cosmos at all. I tend to make them as, it sounds really silly, but I just make little birthday presents for people. If they've got a nice big birthday coming up, my favourite thing to do is just to nip into a studio and spend a week or two just putting a ridiculously, insanely difficult project together for someone. And they went, "Oh, you did that?" I says, "Yeah." And they think that you did it in an afternoon, and no, it was absolutely hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. So that's my idea of fun. But I like doing that on a kind of cottage industry level, not with an idea of flogging it around the world, which I suppose I would do if I was commercially minded. But I just love the idea of songs as kind of little presents, really. So that's my thing. That's what I like doing. But no, there isn't a Patrick Myers solo album coming shortly. I mean, I could change my mind and do one, I suppose, but I don't. I'm not rushing back to the studio to do that anytime soon.
Now, how about with the release of the Queen movie? Has that sparked even more interest in you guys?
Oh, in us. I suppose it inevitably there is a sort of reflected fun in that respect. But really, I think it just reflects. I mean, a movie that's grossed as much as it has, and it's into the 75 million or something now, and it's only been open a short while, but that's worldwide, I think. I mean, it's done incredibly well box office wise. That just reflects the fact that the whole world likes Queen, you know, and wants Queen. So people have asked me, "Oh, do you think there's going to be a resurgence of interest in Queen?" Well, it's not a resurgence of interest if you've got 75 million people.
Yeah.
It's not a resurgence. The interest was already there, idiots. they just needed a film. It's a resurgence if people didn't give a damn about Queen and then started to like them again. People obviously already like them if it's an awful lot all over the world, if it's grossed that much. I mean, I think Brian tweeted, you know, the rock charts or something. I don't know how they compile these things, but like Queen are like occupying downloads. I'm not sure what it was, but I saw it this morning, and Queen records were just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There was something like 15 Queen records all now in the top downloads or whatever it was. So, and that's just unprecedented. I don't think he saw that one coming. So, I mean, there's just people adore Queen, and people want to be given an opportunity to celebrate Queen because it's great, great, great music over such a long period of time, and so diverse music as well. Most bands break up, and Queen did their best to break up on occasions, but kept on getting that bit wrong. and somehow staying together, and that was the only thing they didn't do with aplomb was disintegrate. You know, they managed to somehow keep the ship afloat and keep producing amazing music. And as a result of that, you've got such a wide body of work. Apart from the fact that you've got four different writers that all write in, you know, slightly different styles and get pulled in different directions musically, they also wrote at different stages of their lives and stayed together. I mean, most bands, they hung around. By the time they reach, you know, the 27, 28, 29, the old classic Saturn return, they get the family and off they go, and the whole thing stops, and they get together about 15 years later when they realise they could do with a second home or something. The Queen just stayed together through all of it, and consequently you've got the writing of young men trying to make it. You've got the fertile, fresh imagination of people who are writing their first 20 brilliant songs, you know, but you've also got the songs later on where they're, you know, when they're basically helping Freddie through his last years and writing songs for him, songs like Days of Our Lives, Show Must Go On. They're incredibly mature pieces of work.
Right.
And then Freddie himself with Brian at the end with Mother Love, which is, you know, I mean, absolutely extraordinary song. Literally the last song he recorded. And, you know, Freddie always tried to make out that his songs are about nothing, and he called them disposable razors. You know, you just pick them up and use them, then throw them away. It's pop. That's so disingenuous of him. Massively so, because you can hear him. I think Rami Malek, I think I read something Rami said about this. You can hear Freddie almost keeping a diary on his life. You know, he was a big fan of Lennon, as am I. But Lennon was often, you know, the iconoclast who could only write. He didn't write third party stuff. He always wrote from the heart and stuff. And there's a degree of, definitely a degree of truth in that. But there was obviously a degree of art as well and presenting an image. But Freddie pretended to be the opposite, but was actually much closer to Lennon than that. A lot of his songs were written about heartache because he had quite a, as you know, quite a turbulent life. You know, he didn't help himself enormously at certain points of his life in that respect. But, you know, at other times, you know, he was a guy in a very isolated position. He was writing, you know, a huge bulk of Queen's hits. You know, the rest of the guys were settling down with families and stuff. He that wasn't available to him anymore. And he was a very hedonistic time, you know, and a time of, but at the same time, it ended up being just through the nature of stardom and, you know, wealth and glamour, eventually, inevitably, so often is the case, that, you know, more isolating than he at first realized. And so there was a lot of heartache that came out of that. And you can see that in songs, you know. Sure, he's got the Don't Stop Me Now, you know, hedonistic song. But, you know, there's, for every one of those, there's Love Kills and It's a Hard Life. You know, he points to the heartache fairly quickly, you know. And even songs like Play the Game are quite arch, you know. There's a cynicism creeping in that you start thinking that, you know, this isn't all, you know, a bed of roses, as he put it himself, you know. So, yeah, he's an extraordinary, interesting artist to follow. And the last song he wrote was Mother Love, which was kind of very much, you know, eschewing the whole thing and just saying, I'm a man very much at the end of my road. And, you know, I don't want stormy affairs. I just comfort and care. You know, it was an extraordinary sobering song, but also beautiful and heartfelt, and an extraordinary vocal, actually, considering it's the last thing he recorded. So, what I'm saying is that it's very rare for pop stars to have a body of work that literally lasts a lifetime. It does happen, you know. You've got your Lou Reeds, you've got your Paul Simons, and McCartney and things, and obviously Dylan. And you do get those, you know, Time Out of Mind and Not Dark Yet. There's a whole songs in that raft, but it's very rare for a pop act and a rock act like Queen. They sort of straddle both spheres. To also do that, and I think the Queen are quite unique as a band to have done that. So no, I think it's a stunning body of work, and I think, you know, if 75% of the world already love Queen, I think it's, you know, bands like ours' missions to make sure the other 25% find out about it, because I don't think they're big enough. I think they should be even bigger.
Did you think at all when you heard they were starting to work on a movie, like, oh, I wonder if they're going to contact me?
Well, I had an acting background, so yes, it crossed my mind, but I don't think, I definitely wouldn't have said no, I don't think, but I always put myself on the other side of the fence. What would I do if I was in their situation? Not to do myself down or anything, because as I say, I probably would have jumped at it if it was ever floated, but it wasn't. So, but if I was in their situation, realistically, you want to go all guns blazing with this. And it's so difficult getting backing, and also it's so difficult when you're doing a rock biopic. The one currency that's the hardest to get, you've already got the audience there, the hardest to get is critical credibility, you know, and artistic integrity to the film and things. That's the difficult thing for a rock biopic. So you've got to very much lead with your best foot forward. So you're going to want someone that's bankable, you know, and I think you don't necessarily have to go for a film star these days, because, you know, TV and Netflix and all that sort of stuff is huge. And it's probably the best sort of artistic medium there is out there at the moment in terms of narrative and storyline and stuff. The TV sort of like miniseries and, you know, the series that are coming out. So going for Rami Malek, well, I think was a pretty inspired choice. He's known, he's a good actor, great actor, and he's got that sort of exotic quality. But also you can see that there's heartache behind the eyes a little bit. There's pain there and stuff like that, which very much he had with Freddie. I think that's why people responded to him so much as a performer. It wasn't just that, wow, what a great chap he is. You could see you could hear in his voice, you could hear sort of a lot of power, but a broken heart at the same time coming through. But also a sort of resilience and a determination and a brilliance that overcame all of that. So it's a sort of an extraordinary combination. So I think Rami has done an extraordinary job. You really feel like you're at Live Aid there, you know, standing behind Freddie just before he goes behind out through the curtain and stuff. And at other moments, you really feel like you're watching the conversation between three students at London University back in 1970, trying to work out how they're all going to become rock stars. You know, there's lots of moments where you think, yeah, wow, that's something else, you know. And his unique relationship with Mary and stuff. I mean, they've had to, you know, make it into a narrative. They've had to, you know, compress and reorder and do whatever you need to do to make it work within the context of a two-hour film. But I think the job that they've done is actually incredibly, you know, well done. And very difficult to do and extremely well pulled off. So, yeah, no, kudos to the mighty Queen and all of that. But I think going with established actors rather than, hey, we've got this groovy guy from a tribute band is always going to be a better way forward, I would say. I mean, it's, you know, damn it. maybe I should have just stopped being an actor and hoped I got cast as Freddie Mercury. But that would have been, but actually, I've had much more fun this way around. You know, it, for me, running around the world, singing, just all the time and seeing the whole world and seeing thousands of people singing, for me, I kind of made a decision that was going to be more fun than sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring and trying to go to parties and chat up directors forever. You know, that to me wasn't so much fun. I like you could be slightly more self-determining, I think, when you've got the freedom to sort of like just gig and get out there and make your own world via the medium of Queen's world, but your own world nonetheless. So, yeah, it's good fun.
Absolutely. So, all right, so actually you guys are playing this weekend. You're in Texas and New Orleans.
Yeah, we're just in the North Shore Theatre in Duluth tonight, and then Texas, New Orleans coming up. I think we're travelling tomorrow and doing those, and then we're going to New Jersey and then New York, and then it's back home for some dates in the good old UK after that. And then I'm having a little bit of a break at Christmas.
Next Friday night?
You'll have to tell me. I don't know.
Collinswood, New Jersey. Not far.
Yeah, Collinswood, New Jersey. Yeah. I'm not sure. I haven't got the date in front of me, but we're on the way to New Jersey. I think that's our penultimate date in America. And then it's Flushing, the Kupferberg Center, New York, Queens, I think, Queens College.
Yep.
Which would be great. New Orleans as well. My parents met in New Orleans. So my mum's American, that's going to be. Yeah, they watched the moon landings together in their little shotgun flat back in 1969. It's good. Me coming to America is actually great in lots of ways, actually, because I spent some time here as a kid. My grandparents lived over here, as I say. My mum's from here, so it's nice. And I've got an aunt and some cousins that live over here still as well. So from the other side of the family, so it's bizarre. There seems to be a lot of us all over here, in various different generations.
That's awesome. Well, this has been great talking to you. It's really an honor and interesting to hear your story.
Oh, it's been good fun. It's good. Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to come out next Friday night. The whole family would enjoy it.
Hey, yeah. I mean, a lot of people bring their kids to the show, and they get in touch and say, is your show okay for us to bring our child to? Because he absolutely adores Queen, and absolutely, yes, it is. It's how I discovered rock and roll, really, through Queen and seeing their performances. And I think, as I said before, it's a real pretty bulletproof blueprint for a great rock and roll show, and a great introduction, you know, in terms of for anyone who wants to see a rock show in there, you know. And loads of the kids, that's what's so amazing, loads of the kids, and I'm talking about 8, 9, 10, 11 year olds, sometimes younger, they're there with their parents, and they know the words. They're not going, what's all this about then, mum and dad? You know, they're sort of saying, oh yeah, it's Don't Stop Me Now, it's We Will Rock You, it's Another One Bites the Dust. They know the stuff, you know. It's like ingrained into the sort of DNA of great music to listen to when you're growing up. So we get a lot of fun playing for whole families, and you know, you get vast swathes of generations that like Queen now. It's quite ridiculous. But yeah, it's great.
All right, so where should we send everybody to find you and keep up to date on you? Social media, website?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you go to killerqueen.com, that's probably the easiest to remember. And then the social media buttons are all at the top. So there is Facebook, there is Twitter, there's Instagram and all that sort of stuff. So, and YouTube channels and all that sort of thing. So, but yeah, if you just remember Killer Queen and then just put .com at the end of it, that will open the whole portal of all things Killer Queen related for you. But yes, there's plenty of updates on Instagram and loads of nice posts on Facebooks and lots of great audience reactions and all that sort of thing. So yeah, it's amazing. It's great. I love all that social media stuff, actually. It's great to have such great direct contact with everybody, and you know, people write in and they do little personal messages, or they write underneath the photos we've taken of the show and stuff. And I just love all that. I think it's so great to get, you know, and it's so immediate as well. That's what's so good about it, you know. It's brilliant.
How about that? Like, when you meet people, like, I mean, are you signing autographs? Like, do they want you to sign Freddie Mercury?
To be honest, I don't do a lot of that, really. I don't do a lot of, I think they call them meet and greets, and I'm not against them, but I tend to shy away from them a little bit. Mainly because I'm really tired. After a show, the last thing I want to do is another half hour of hello. But I do, when I do meet people, I really enjoy it, I have to say. So there's two sides to it, really. I'm usually a little bit exhausted, so I tend to sort of like disappear in a little sort of pool afterwards. But when I do meet people, which happens from time to time, I obviously, I'm still in costume. I don't ever sort of meet people as me. I'll meet them as the chap they saw on stage. And when I sign autographs, which they do ask for, I sign it as me, and then put in brackets Freddie in terms of who I was playing, just so they know, because they're not going to remember who the hell Patrick Myers is in 2 years' time. I think, who wrote on my poster? Oh. So I put in brackets Freddie, just so there's some historical context of what on earth they're doing with a tribute poster on their wall, you know, all those years later. I sign it as myself first, because it would be a bit weird to start signing it as someone else. Put a little brackets to explain who everyone is. I think we all do that when we sign the posters and stuff. But yeah, good question though, worth asking.
Oh, that's funny. Well, Patrick, thanks again for doing this. This was great talking to you.
Great. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, too. Great questions. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Speak soon. Bye.
Take care. All right, welcome back. Tudor Radio, Bay Ragney here, and there he is, Patrick Myers of Killer Queen, a.k.a. Freddie Mercury of Killer Queen. So, there you go. There's a bunch of tour dates going on right now. Actually, this weekend, they are playing in Corpus Christi, Texas, and tomorrow night they're playing in New Orleans, Louisiana, at the Harrah's New Orleans Casino. Next Thursday, Friday, Saturday, they got dates. They're going to be in Oklahoma City on Thursday. On Friday, they're going to be at the Scottish Rite in Collingswood, New Jersey, which is outside here, the Philadelphia area. And Saturday, they're up at the Kupfberg Center for the Arts in Flushing, New York. And then they head back home to the UK for more dates. So just go to Killer Queen for more info. You can find them on Facebook and Instagram. Just look for Killer Queen. And look for us, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, Totally Driven Entertainment, Totally Driven Radio. Like us, love us, follow us, and do the same for me, Bay Ragney. So, all right, thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Until next time, stay driven. See you, everybody.